Hi, I'm Mireya Loza. It is the 11th of January, 2008. I am in the Estrella Community College in Arizona. I'm here with Ilio J. Pompa.
Ilio, can you actually state your birth name, your full birth name?
Sure. As it's on my birth certificate, it's Jesus Eliobardo Pompa. But that name was changed for me when I was in sixth grade. I had an Anglo teacher, Mrs. Smith, I'll never forget her. She said my name, it's not one that she liked, she didn't care for it, she shortened it, played with it, and she mentioned one day, she goes, Ilio Bardo, your name now is Ilio, because I'm not going to say the whole thing. I mean, what did I know? I was in sixth grade, so. Ever since then, I've been Ilio Pompa.
Can you tell me a bit about when and where you were born?
I was born in Chihuahua, Mexico in 1956. My dad had been a bracero in the very early 50s. He and my mother had married early. And as a bracero, he saw an opportunity. He'd heard about it through friends, relationships that he had in Mexico. And my understanding, and over many conversations with my dad, in the very early 50s, he had an opportunity to come over as a bracero. So he came over with a group of men, I want to say at least a dozen. And like the bracero project was intended to do the labor shortages that were going on because of the war, he had opportunities to work in several parts of Arizona, Southern California, Texas, New Mexico. And over time, he settled in Casa Grande, Maricopa, Stanfield, pretty much the southwest region of Maricopa County. Mm-hmm. And it was time for him to go back to Mexico. He had a wife, and both my sister and myself were conceived, born in Mexico. He came back as a bracero back in from 52 back to about 56, 57. And my sister and I were with my mom in Chihuahua. And then he came back and got us and applied for visas. We got our visas to enter the United States legally and began to make a life for us here in about late 1957.
Do you remember what life was like in Chihuahua with you and your mom when your father left?
You know, I was probably about a year and a half old. So those memories for me are non-existent. I just don't remember. My sister tells me of the apartment, if you will, that we lived in, central Chihuahua with, aunts and uncles close by. But I don't have much of a memory of growing up in Chihuahua. Obviously, I was too young. My memories are more of when I'm here in the United States, in Arizona.
What age did you come to the U.S. at?
I was about two. So in about late 1957, early 1958 is when we arrived, and by that time I was about 2.5 years old. When my memories start to click in, so to speak, I remember being about four, and I still have very vivid memories of we moved a lot, and I didn't know why we moved a lot, other than we just moved with a group of people. There was a lot of braceros. There was some with family, some without. We were the minority in terms of my dad being a bracero. He was the one that worked on bringing his family over. But there was a lot of single men. I remember that. The white hats, the cowboy shirts, the jeans, the boots. And they had a certain work ethic that I remember, that when it was time to go to work, you went to work. I tell stories to my own kids about what I remember starting as early as age four. People used to pick cotton. Now they have machines that do it. But back then, we used to have this long sack that was probably 10 or 12 feet beneath your legs. You had a belt. You clipped it on. If you were old enough to walk, you went to the work site. My mom, my dad, my sister, me. And at that time, even my youngest brother, Humberto, who was born in Texas, And up until many years later, we didn't realize, and we didn't really know why he was born in Texas, but it was part of that seasonal traveling that Humberto was born in San Antonio. But I remember that long sack between your legs. All I was told is take that little cotton, put it between your legs. And being, you know, 4.5, 5 years old, I was just, I thought that was life. That's what we do. We just worked. And I remember looking around, and there was dozens and dozens of people doing the same thing that I was. Some with families, most without. And that was my introduction to the United States labor force. As young as we were, you were put to work, not so much by, if anything else, more for necessity. You know, the more people obviously working, the more money was generated. So,
do you recall whether families who worked in the camps like yourself were mixed together to work with these single men, these braceros, or did you guys work in separate spheres?
No, you know, we were kind of all in one group. The men, the braceros that I remember my dad working off with another group, and I'm not sure if that was by design in terms of they had the hardest work going on that day, and they would leave some of the women and the kids in a different part of the camp or the place where we were working. Whether it was the grapes, whether it was cotton, whether it was onions, whether it was beets, I have a saying that, you know, somebody asked me not too long ago, says, well, what exactly did you pick when you were a kid? I said, well, pretty much if you ate it, I think we picked it. That's what I remember. But I remember my dad being gone for up to 8-10 hours, and we wouldn't see him till later. Sometimes they would get picked up, trucked, and taken to another work site. And I'm sure that was by design. They had just different priorities for them.
Do you recall where you lived during this period when you moved around?
I remember living in Casa Grande, in an area that most people would probably relate to third world conditions. Dirt floors, no heating. If you were going to cook, you cooked outside. Outhouses, and if you were lucky to have an outhouse, that was a luxury. And when it really came to, I don't know if I had a flashback or what, but years ago with the movie La Bamba, mm-hmm. at the very beginning of the movie, they show what I think is part of that bracero movement where these, you know, Richie and his mom and their family live in an orchard. They have tents, they cooked outside, they made tortillas and frijoles, and mm-hmm. the men, you know, they're out working, and mom was left with the kids, and if they were working, they were out. But that kind of popped into my head. It was like a light bulb went on. I went, I don't know if subconsciously I had wanted to forget that or had just forgotten it, but when I saw that part of the movie, I went, I lived that life. I lived that life from about the age of 4 through about 7 or 8. And I remember that. I remember the tents. I remember the people. But those were conditions that, as a child, we thought that was as good as it gets. That was life. That was our home. That was, we cooked dinner over an open flame at night. And that's just the way it was done. And then, you know, a few weeks would pass. You'd pack everything up, put it on a panel station wagon. You'd hitch rides with people and trucks, and you'd move on to the next site. I remember Stanfield, living in Stanfield, Maricopa, Casa Grande. The furthest south or southern part of the valley now. And I remember going to Texas in the San Antonio, Austin area. And that's in that region that my brother was born. And we also went to Southern California. You know, we went to San Jose for a brief period of time. And after discussions with my dad, because when I got to be about 5.5, 6 years old, we settled in an area called Litchfield Park, or Waddell, in that area. And my dad, bless his heart, I think he saw and he had a vision of what he wanted for his family. He didn't want us traveling and being those seasonal workers. And I remember talking to my dad years ago. He says, no, I wanted an education for you guys. I wanted us to to grow roots somewhere. And the only way to do that was to take a job with Goodyear Farms. And when he went to work for Goodyear Farms, that's when the camp life started. And a lot of the braceros and their families, relatives, whatever, saw that very same opportunity. And when we settled in at the camp, which is on Litchfield Road and Alsup, which is all red tile roofs and stucco homes now, we actually had a home. I didn't know what it was like to step on concrete floors and, to sit on a couch. And I don't think I saw my first TV till I was probably 4.5 or 5 years old. But we were just thrilled to death. We thought we'd just moving on up, baby. We're in the camps now, so we're somebody. You know, our names are in the phone book. It doesn't matter because we didn't have a phone anyway. But that is my most vivid memories, is arriving at the camps and then creating those relationships with the other families, that they were the same as us. They weren't any different.
What were the living conditions of the braceros in relationship to the families? Did they have a specific area that was designated for them?
You know, I think my dad, as hard as he was, disciplinarian, man, he's one of the hardest workers I've ever met, which I think translated to a lot of the characteristics that my brothers and my sisters now have as far as work ethic go. But I remember him being a very generous man. You know, reaching out and inviting 3 or 4 of them to dinner. My mom would sometimes complain, "No tengo suficiente, ¿qué me estás haciendo? You're killing me, you're bringing all these guys for dinner." But he saw, I think, these men struggling to just get enough to eat and not making enough money to sustain themselves, but yet also inviting them into his house. Even though if it was just a tent or under a tree or by the truck or even at the camp, that's something that my dad did. But they had worse living conditions. I remember visiting with my dad, and when there wasn't work, unfortunately the culture, well, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but the way these people, they worked hard, but they loved to party. They loved their beer and their cigarettes because everybody smoked. And their tequila, and if you had some burritos and frijoles and beer and tequila, the music was always going. There was always a guitar somewhere. Somebody always played the guitar. I'll never, ever forget that. And the most amazing thing is my dad would invite these men, but they were isolated in an area where if you don't have a family and if you don't have little ones with you, it was nothing more than a blanket on the floor. A blanket on the floor, and you were lucky if you had a roof over your head. But that's what I remember about my dad, just being an incredibly generous guy, inviting them to our dinner table, inviting them for a drink of water or a beer, or, come over here and spend some time with us, and giving them something. And I think it made some of them feel very homesick because they had that family back in Mexico. They just opted to leave and for a better life. And I'm positive that the reason my dad did that is because he was there once without a family. And he was just giving back.
Mm-hmm. And how did a lot of the braceros treat you at the age of 4 and 5? Seeing as though they missed their children.
I remember them always digging in their pocket and giving us a quarter or a nickel. If they had a quarter, they'd give it to you. Or if they had a dime, they'd hand you something. And I don't know if that's part of the culture or part of that Mexican culture deep in Mexico. I remember when we'd visit Mexico and my cousins and aunts and uncles later, one of my uncles would always reach in his pocket and this crusty little old greasy peso, he'd hand it to his, "Toma, mijo." And they'd give you money. It's like, okay, well, he's handing me money. Let's go spend it. But I remember always them being very gentle. They were grateful, I think. And my dad used to make me and my brother, this is so embarrassing, he used to make us sing. By this time, my brother and I were in kindergarten and first grade, and we did the Pledge of Allegiance, and of course you had to sing the Star Spangled Banner, and me and my brother didn't know any other words. It was around Christmas time, we'd sing the Christmas songs, and he said, "Mira, mijo, ven pa acá y quiero que cantes por estos muchachos." "Come on, Dad, don't make us sing." "No queremos cantar." "No, cabrones, van a cantar, vénganse para acá." So me and my brother would stand there like we're at attention, like we're in the Marine Corps, and we'd sing Jingle Bells, Merry Christmas. I mean, we'd sing the Star Spangled Banner, and afterwards it's like, okay, are you done now? But he would do that. He said, mira, estos son mijos. And my dad was so proud. There was never a prouder moment than when I think he realized that he had transitioned from Mexico to America, and his kids were in school. They're getting an education. We're building a life, and we had roots. We were just, it's like planting seeds in the garden and watching them grow. Those are things that you don't realize then, but you realize later.
And was the relationship that they had with you any different than with your sister, seeing as though she was a girl?
No, I don't think the relationship was any different. I think as that culture goes, I think, you know, certainly the women married very early. Mm-hmm. And there was, I remember much later on in life when my older sister was in her, you know, late teens, 14, 15, 16. Yeah, they were looking at her a little bit differently, and we're like, and me and my, you know, I was 4 years younger than her, so she was 16, I was 12. I think my parents raised us in a manner, strict Catholics, between right and wrong. But in that regard, yeah, there was always certain situations that we might get ourselves a little bit more into a riskier place than. But you know what? I think my father was a big guy. Big guy. I'm not small, as you can see, but he was bigger than I was. Just a towering man. Very intimidating. I don't think they wanted to mess with my dad. And you know what? I remember so many parties. I remember it was fun because my mom and dad would be getting dressed up and they said, quiero que se arreglen, vamos a ir para el campo 52, tienen un party allá y vamos para allá. And it was a seasonal thing, or it was the holidays, or it was just because. We're going over, you know, Mage's house. I remember Mage and Lupe, and we'd go there, and they had kids. So we'd get there, and the kids would go off and play, and the ladies would be in one corner talking and drinking, and the men would be around the beer talking and drinking, and like I said, somebody else had a guitar. There was always music. There was music at every party, and it was always so much fun. We didn't want to leave. I mean, we're talking late, late into the hours, 11, 12, 1 o'clock. And everything is still going on, and there were families that were just congregating. We all knew each other. I mean, we knew which camp you lived in. We knew the bus had to swing by, pick up the kids at Camp 52, and then 53, and 54, and then it would finally drop us off at school. So we knew each other through several areas. Number one, school. Number two was we all worked the same fields together, and our families grew up together. Mm-hmm. And we had so much in common.
So how were these men who were in these communities for, say, for instance, 3 to 6 months, socialized? Would they get integrated really quickly?
You know what? They did. And primarily because of the work that they all did was the same work that my dad did. And my dad and some of the other families, I think, were extending, I think, just being out of courtesy or just being gracious host to them, because we knew they were just there for just a short period of time. And it's amazing because sometimes the families that came in with seasonal braceros left. And you'd have great relationships with these kids. And all of a sudden, from one day to the next, there was no notice. They just left. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't have an obligation to tell you, by the way, we're moving out and we're leaving next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. You know, from one day to the next, they'd be gone. But they did integrate well into that culture because they were one and the same. They were almost like, not necessarily a band of brothers, but they were all after the same goal, mm-hmm. to make money, to take advantage of the opportunities. And most of them, I remember, were single. Mm-hmm. I remember my dad trying to set many of those braceros up with, you know, some of the younger women, some of the single women that just were part of that culture that were born here, but not part of the bracero movement. And yeah, they did integrate well. And we all spoke the same language. We were all trying to do the same thing.
When your dad would try to set them up, were there ever any successful matches?
You know, I can't tell you that for a fact, but I just remember that there was this this dance hall in Avondale. It was called the Big Seven. And that was a place to be on Fridays and Saturday nights. Kuko was the main guitar player. And he was the singer. It was his band. And I got to tell you, I learned to drive a car at the age of 4 1/2. I had my first accident at 6. Drove my car into the ditch, or my dad's car into the ditch, and he wasn't very happy with me, but I couldn't reach the pedals, couldn't reach the brakes. But he used to put a hat on me, put a big pillow and a blanket. Mira, mijo, te va a mirar como un hombre. Let's go drive. And off, I'd take mom to groceries. But the Big Seven was a nightclub, and it was mostly for 99.9% Hispanic. It was right there on Highway 80 and Central Avenue in Avondale. And I used to drive my parents there. I did. My dad used to put this little black suit on. Where he got it, I have no idea. Black tie, white shirt. He'd put the same suit on. He kind of reminded me of Barney Fife. Because he always had a little bow on. He always had his hat on. My dad was a very handsome man. He was a very, very attractive, very handsome, very kind of a man's man. He just was. My mom, jet black hair, beautiful eyes, just had that movie star character, just striking. And they were a hot-looking couple. And they'd get out and they'd dance. They'd always invite a couple. And sometimes I remember, wait a minute, who's that guy in the back? You know, it dawned on me. It's like, oh, that's one of the braceros, or one of the workers, that seasonal guys. And there'd be another lady in the back. I'd drive them to the Big Seven. They'd dance, drink, sometimes heavily. But I was their designated driver. I didn't know that's what I was called, but I was their driver. So a lot of fights there. I remember that. Hispanic men are very passionate about their relationships, about their women. And tragically, several years later, Kuko was like the Elvis Presley of the camps. He was just hot. He could play the guitar. He could play the accordion. He had his own band. He worked for Goodyear Farms, but he was kind of like the boss. He'd have all of these people that chopped cotton for him, lettuce, onions, you name it. But he had a work group that he was in charge of, the pay and the hours and things like that. And during the summer, and sometimes when the kids were in school, most of his workforce was women. And like I said, he had that Elvis Presley persona. And I know, and these are memories that, you know, up until about 15, 20 years ago, I didn't really put together. But all of the women adored him. I mean, it's like that rock star mentality that he had. But tragically, he was murdered at the Big Seven. I think I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. And I just remember that the camp, because he lived, we had a row of houses, and there was like 5 or 6 units per building, 2 bedrooms each. Ours was 2 bedrooms with 8 people, 6 kids and mom and dad. And he lived in the very next building, and I still remember his son, Joey. Cataño was his last name. And just woke up one day, and I remember my dad, because we all worked for Kuko, you know, chopping cotton. He said, "Mataron al Kuko anoche." And he told me about that. And it just kind of, it was probably one of the darkest times I remember in the camps, because he represented a lot of things. That, you know, we work hard, we play hard. And he had a great family. And after that, it seemed like that band, that Big Seven, that nightclub thing, it just had a really dark cloud over it. And it never recovered. And it was amazing how one person could have that kind of influence on a community, our little community. But he did. And it was like when Elvis Presley died, everybody was like, oh my God, what happened? So I just remember my parents just, they were bummed for years after that.
You were talking a bit about the layout of the camp. Can you describe it a bit?
So yeah.
You said that there was, picture, you lived in a row. Yeah.
Picture a big football field. Mm-hmm. And the track around it. That's what it was. It was an oval camp, just like a football field. And where the bleachers would be, that's where the row of houses were. And they went all the way around. And you could and it was split in the middle. So when you came into the camp, you'd essentially be splitting in the middle of the football field, like you'd be coming in at the 50-yard line from two directions, and then you'd either get into the loop, and you'd see the houses around the corners. And the houses were probably, and they weren't even houses. They were small, small buildings, 800 square feet, if that, per family. And the roadways in the middle, that was our baseball field when we were growing up. That was our football field. It was our hide-and-seek place. And if we got outside of the camp in any direction to the south, it was cotton fields, onion fields, rose fields, watermelon fields. Goodyear Farms had a really small, kind of like an operational yard where they kept some tractors and things like that. That we kind of played in that area, but a lot of ditches, a lot of trees, and we made use of everything in terms of playing. You know, we just did. And, that's where I grew up. That was my life in that camp.
So you guys would actually play, say, for instance, something like baseball, or I don't know if you guys played soccer, but in these roads?
We didn't play soccer because we didn't know there was a round ball anywhere. we had a football, we had a baseball, we had a bat, and the Frostos. The Frostos were another family like ours, large. They had six or seven kids. We had six. And they had peculiar names, but they were endearing names, but I couldn't figure out, how'd you get a name like Titi, you know? There was Titi, there was Chiquillo, there was Chiquilla, there was Tolio, Tonque. And their real names were like Lorenzo, Javier, Alfredo. Mm-hmm. But how they got those other names, I don't know. That's just how we knew them. Today's, you know, kid culture is you go to the door, you ring the doorbell, or you call them, or you send them a text to say, hey, you want to play, you want to hang out. We were so stupid. We didn't know any better. Me and my brother, Bert, Humberto back then, we just go and stand outside their apartment, if you will. We'd yell their name. We didn't go anywhere near the door. We just yell their name. It's like, and all of a sudden, about 30 seconds later, they'd come out. Hey, how you doing? Hey, you want to go hang out? Let's go throw the ball. Let's go ride bikes or something. But that was so primitive. It's like, we didn't know enough to knock and say, is Chiquillo here? We didn't do it. We just yelled their name. They'd do the same thing in our house. And it's like, don't ask me why. To this day, I'm thinking, why did we yell their names? And we yelled it loud. And, you know, if you were inside watching TV or doing something, you'd hear the name. It was like, you know, your radar goes on. It's like, ah, they're calling me. And off you go, and you'd go hang out. We laugh about it now, myself and my brothers, when we bring that up. I said, you know, I should do that to you one of these days, Ramiro. And he was in a very nice, very upscale neighborhood. I should come over to your house and instead of ringing the doorbell, I should just yell your name. He goes, nah, man, the homeowner association will kick us out. Don't do that. But it was just bizarre stuff that we did back then. We just didn't know any better.
So if the family lived around the football stadium, these braceros, the braceros who lived in the camp, where would they be?
They lived in whatever was vacant. And there were times during the year that the people who had settled, there was probably only like four or five families, and there was enough there for probably about 20 families. And they would live in a vacant house, one that was available, but they never had the heat turned on. They lived by candlelight. They heated stuff up outside. And they had a mattress on the floor, if they were lucky. And that was it. They just isolated them to one part of the camp. And there wasn't a segregated, this is the family side, this is the bracero side. It's whatever was open, whatever, you know, happened to be there for the taking, if you will.
And how was there someone assigned to cook? Did they just cook themselves?
You know, they were the housekeeper, they were the cooks, they you could tell which men had been together for a while and which ones had traveled the seasonal work, wherever it was, which ones were traveling as a group. Because, you know, it's almost like a fraternity. They hung out together. They drank their beer together. They partied together. They'd come over and you know, pay Dad or one of the other neighbors. We were one of the fortunate ones to have car. The Frostos had a car. The Alcantars had a car. The Lopez's had a car. But they'd come over and ask for a ride into town. And they'd pay you a dollar or two for, you know, for your troubles and stuff. But
did you drive them?
I did. On more than one occasion. Mijo, quiero que lleves a la tienda. ¿Quieren ir para la tienda? Te van a dar un dólar. And I'm thinking, wow, a dollar. What can I do with a dollar? Back then, I could do a lot with a dollar. And, you know, I didn't have to save as many pop bottles to go buy a pop or a candy bar. But, gladly. I got pulled over one time by the only sheriff that worked the entire west part of Maricopa County. I got pulled over. And it just freaked me out. I couldn't have been more than 8 or 9 years. I had my hat on. I was sitting on my blanket. I had my little wood block on my shoe so I could push the pedals. And I had two guys in the back with me. And he went one direction. I was going the other. And into town, it was only like about 2 miles into Litchfield Park. And he turned around, pulled over, and he goes, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 8. He goes, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm taking these guys to the store." And these poor braceros, they were so nervous because they thought, great, you know, pay this guy to take us into town. And now we're going to get either A, thrown in jail, or B, deported. And I'm 8 years old negotiating with a police officer why I have these two men in the back. I'm taking them to the grocery store. They don't have anything to eat. I mean, that was the bottom line. He goes, "Well, I can't let you drive." And I'm going, "Well, I'm a seasoned driver. I've been driving for about 4 years." And of course, he didn't buy that. I was trying to, you know, humor my way out of it. But nevertheless, I was scared to death because I thought I was going to go to jail. He put us all back in the back of his car, parked the car, took us back to the camp, and he dropped us off. And he goes, "Don't do that again." Of course, that didn't stop me. I kept driving. But yeah, that was an interesting story. But yeah, I used to haul these guys around.
In that occasion, did the police officer ask the braceros for ID or anything?
You know what? No. No. There was a certain understanding that this sheriff's deputy, and I wish I could remember his name. What I remember of him as a child, just a kind, older man. And when I say older, I'm talking at that time, probably late 50s, early 60s. And I think he was well aware of, you know, west of Litchfield Park, that's where the migrants are, that's where the illegals are, that's where the Mexicans are. That's their work zone, that's their stuff. Unless there was true trouble, fights, I don't remember any ever, gunfire, no gang activity. It was such a, I don't want to say clean life in terms of crime, but we weren't exposed to city problems. We just weren't. So he left us alone. He really did. And he'd cruise by every now and then. He'd wave at everybody. Everybody'd wave at him. And everybody knew his name. He was just a really nice guy, so he never asked us. There is one story that comes to mind that you asked me about. Did they ever ask for ID? I remember we were chopping cotton. Cotton was probably about 2.5-3 feet high. And in the summertime, that would start the day after school was over. You got your hoe, you sharpened it up, got your hat, your gloves. I had a little transistor radio, used to put it on my belt, which is now I remember why everybody hung around me. I thought I was cool, but it was because I was the one that had the music. So, and I remember building relationships with other families that would come in for the seasonal work. And you see the braceros, the single guys that are around, you know, they always wear the white hat. I don't know what it was with the white hat. They all had a white hat. Nobody had a black hat. All these braceros always had a white hat. But we're chopping cotton, and I was first introduced to La Migra at an early age. to me, I didn't know what the hell that meant. What's La Migra? I didn't know. I was about 8 years old, 7 years old. And we're doing our thing, chopping the weeds out of the cotton. And one of the men screamed, La Migra. Ahí viene La Migra. Vámonos. And everybody out of that 15 or 20 workforce, with the exception of me and my older sister and some of the other teens, we spoke English. We look around like, why is everybody running? You know? And these guys dropped their tools, and they are literally running as fast as they can. Because off in the distance, you could see the olive green vans in a trail of dust coming. And I'm going, why is everybody running? Mm-hmm. And it didn't dawn on me until later, when the big bus came. There was a green bus that came. They were making an immigrant bust, an illegal immigration bust. And I got picked up. And one of the guys comes up to me and says, ¿Tus papeles? He asked me in Spanish, so I figure I better answer this guy in Spanish. Los tiene mi papá. ¿Dónde está tu papá? Está trabajando. My dad would drop us off. He had to go do his job. And he goes, ¿Dónde eres? De México. Okay. ¿No tienes papeles? No. No tengo papeles. If he'd asked me in Spanish, I'd have answered it. If he'd asked me in English, I would have answered in English. And all I remember is jumping on this bus, and I'm going, we're going for a ride, or what's the deal here? I'm like, field trip time, anything, like, I don't have to work anymore. This is cool. Where are we all going? And I wasn't exactly the brightest at 8 years old, but one of the guys told me, says, they're taking us back to Mexico. And I'm going, oh, the light bulb came on. I went, hey, time out. Wait a minute. It took 1 hour. 1 hour for me to convince these people that, yes, I was born in Mexico. I do have papers. I just don't have them with me. My dad, it just so happened that Cuco, the band guy, the Elvis Presley of the community, he came over and said, no, this young man belongs to Hildardo Pompa, who works for Goodyear Farms, who is here legally. So you have no right to take this young man. He says, he needs to stay here. And it was really one of these things. He's going, he's staying, he's going, he's staying. And honestly, for a few minutes I thought, man, I'm going back to Mexico, and I don't know what I'm going to do when I get there. Okay, so it was pretty frightening. But you know, the most tragic part about that is young men that came over as braceros, they were as young as 16, 17 years old. Men, by the Hispanic and Mexican standards, but still kids by American standards, that never really had a childhood, but they were here to work and send money back, they'd be gone. They'd never see them again. That part was sad to see. You'd see families disappear.
Were there any braceros of the other type which had temporary work contracts that were able to stay there?
Oh, yeah. You could, it was as clear as night and day, because they would take their wallet, and I still remember the immigration officials examining it and looking at it and examining and looking and giving it back, and they were legal. They could stay. They had a work visa. They were there legally. And those are the ones that got to stay. And that used to happen 3 or 4 times a summer. And those are the people that I didn't understand it then, but I understand it now, as to they had a right to be here for work. They were part of that braceros movement. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was a lot of them that stayed, but those poor people who didn't have any documentation, families were uprooted. I mean, men, women, their kids, adios, see you later.
And did those two types, the documented and the undocumented type, mix together? The men who had their bracero ID, who came through the program, did they mix in with the undocumented people?
Where I grew up, yes. Mm-hmm. They all mixed in together. They all blended well together. There was...
And so you kind of saw them as one community because they were always together.
Absolutely. I don't remember any conflict where there was a choosing of sides. Well, you're here legally, I'm here illegally. It didn't make us any different. In that regard, I don't remember any conflict between, I don't remember anybody ever picking sides.
Did you notice that there was one group that had better conditions, work conditions or living conditions?
I think the people that were here legally, mm-hmm. I think knew the laws better. And I think they were more accustomed to the system, if you will, in terms of the opportunities that were there for them were greater in terms of choice of work, places to live, rather than the people who were here illegally. But nevertheless, the conditions were never like a five-star resort. I mean, it just wasn't. Mm-hmm. But there was clearly a difference in, they would dress differently, the braceros. Well, they still had their white hat, believe it or not. They had two white hats, one for work and one for going out. One was clean, one was dirty. Because my dad had that. It's like, wow, what's with the white hat? But I don't know, maybe they were all just good guys deep down underneath, or superheroes, one or the other. But they just dressed differently. They always had a very neatly white pressed shirt. Cowboy style, vaquero style. Boots, the belts, the big buckles. And you could tell that they were making money. And they were, up to a certain point, they were seeing some of that success of making American money. You could clearly tell there was a difference in the way they dressed, the braceros, versus the individuals who didn't have any documentation, who were here illegally, if you will. But when they had less. They had less. We used to give a lot of clothes away. Like I said, my parents were very, very generous. I remember walking over to families in sacks of clothing, whether it was T-shirts or socks or things that we obviously didn't wear anymore. We'd take them over there, but it was very evident that they just didn't have as much. You know, they were looking for rides wherever they went. To us at that time, they were just another group of kids to play with. But
did you guys ever play like baseball with them?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We were always looking for extras for baseball, for football, and speaking Spanish initially, they didn't speak English, so we had to kind of work that out a little bit. But we at that time, you know, growing up, we were in first, second, fifth, sixth grade, seventh grade. we thought we were like it because not only were we here, you know, we spoke English, and there was sometimes a little bit of a barrier in communication. But yeah, they were our friends just like everybody else was. And you know, as you get older, you know, you'd kind of, you know, coming up on seventh and eighth grade, wow, that girl's like really cute. You know, they'd have these every time there was a party in the camp. There was always live music. And if there wasn't live music, there was always music somewhere. So you always had an opportunity to build on relationships, to make new friends and things like that. But most of these families were traveler, seasonal workers. And they'd be gone from one day to the next. So you almost kind of, it was instilled and you can't build too many relationships with these people because from one day to the next, they'd be gone. But we knew who the steadfast families were that were there, and, you know.
Did you ever notice if some of the braceros who came through the program wanted to date girls that were born in the U.S. or
oh, yeah.
Raised in the U.S. so that they could stay?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That happened?
Oh, in the camps? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The families that were there, you know, as time progressed, they had sisters or people that were coming and migrating from Mexico, relatives that were parts of the other camps, you know, sisters of a family or brothers, or you could see how, yeah, there was probably a lot more going on that I probably paid attention to. But, you know, the Hispanic culture, the Mexican culture is such that, you know, certainly Hispanic men love their women. You can't have too much fun without a woman. You got to have somebody to dance with, and, you know, I don't know where, if you'd take somebody out to dinner back then, what you'd do other than just, you know, go to the parties and those types of things. But, yeah, you know, but those are things that you just don't remember till later. Elvira, Mexican lady, I remember her as very attractive, very, very pretty. Kind of had that, I could be way off on this, but kind of had Marilyn Monroe blonde hair. She was the only lady with blonde hair that spoke Spanish. And to me, that was kind of odd. How can she speak Spanish if her hair is blonde? But come to find out later, she dyed it, of course. So she had a couple of sisters and relationships that the braceros would get themselves close to, and they had a lot of fun. That's all I remember. But yeah, it wasn't uncommon for a bracero to infiltrate, if you will, you know, a certain family or group for the purpose of wanting to date. And they probably knew that if I marry here, there's a good opportunity I can stay here legally. So how many of those relationships actually occurred, I have no idea.
And during the dances, just out of curiosity, was there ever any music that they played that came from different regions of Mexico that you noticed or that you didn't recognize?
It was always very festive. Mm-hmm. A lot of accordion, a lot of Tejano music, a lot of guitar. And we used to poke fun of the adults because the music would get louder, the dancing would get more, everybody's dancing, whereas initially, you know, somebody would always start the dancing. Whether you're dancing on a concrete patio or dancing out on the grass, somebody would always start dancing. We would always gauge how much booze was on board with the dancing, the yelling, and the Mexican screams that they give, but the music was a lot of Tejano, a lot of accordion, but we knew for a fact that when the men started putting their arms around each other and singing, it's like, okay, all right, this party's out of control. So everybody's singing, everybody's dancing. I just remember they worked hard, but boy, they sure loved the party. They had a lot of fun with that. But the music, I still have a lot of it in some playing in my own car right now from my dad's era, that just, for no other reason, I just like it. But as far as the music goes, I just remember a lot of accordion, a lot of guitar, very, very danceable type music. Some ballads from time to time were played where, I don't know why some men cried when they got really intoxicated. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, although I can guess, either they, A, were homesick, they missed their families, or they just were in a place where they got very emotional. And as kids, we're looking, why is that guy crying? You know, right? He's, and you know, you'd see people rally to him, hey, it's all right, you know. Whether they lost a loved one or memories of mom and dad or memories growing up. But I just remember some of those things. They were odd to me. It's like, I don't understand why these guys are all crying. Okay, so is that what we're supposed to? Because I hope I don't do that when I get to be older. But that's what they did. And I'm sure it's probably just old memories surfacing, mm-hmm. or missing Mexico.
Did you notice any of these men were from specific regions of Mexico?
I did. It seemed like the darker, mm-hmm. the bracero, the further south he was from Mexico. Mm-hmm. And my dad told me that. The lighter complected people were closer to the border. I don't know why. It, culturally, geographically, I don't know what that is, but there were different names, mestizos, mexicanos, eras chihuahuense, or de Sinaloa. There were some men that I remember, because my dad was born in Sinaloa. He used to call me tierra, esa es mi tierra, from Obregón. They were lightheaded, almost redheaded blonde. Green eyes, light complected, and they had a different dialect. They had a different way they spoke. And I'm going, that guy speaks funny. His dialect is different. He's got an accent. And the darker the bracero, the further south they were from Mexico.
Did you notice if there was any specific states where you thought, wow, there's a lot of people from here?
I don't. I want to say a lot of people. I remember my dad meeting a lot of people and a lot of men that would come over and they'd share our dinners. You know, ¿de dónde eres tú? And yo soy de Yo soy de Oaxaca. Y yo soy de afuera de Guadalajara. No, yo vengo de Sinaloa, yo vengo de Obregón. And they talk about mi tierra, you know, mi tierra, my home country is this, or and they'd have some pretty good conversations about that. But they all talked about their life back in Mexico. It's something they could all relate to. And the bond between these men, these braceros, was that they all came from Mexico. They all had something in common, even though they all had many differences personally in the way they either lived or they were raised or, but the one thing that bonded them was when they came over, that they all had one goal in mind, and that was to be successful, make money.
After 64, the program, the Bracero program ended. Did you notice any difference in the camp? You were about 9 years old, nine going on 10 at that point. Did you notice anything around that period that you thought was peculiar?
We didn't have as many people leaving the camp. It seemed like the camps began to establish themselves as little communities, real little communities. They began to have an identity. They began to have names associated with camps. We could get on our bikes, and we knew that we could visit the Alcantares at Camp 54, the Sotos at 54, and we knew that they were going to be there next Christmas. We knew that they were going to be there next Easter when these families would get together for these parties. So now that you mention it, yeah, they began to get an identity in terms of the number of families that were there. Prior to that, it was very migratory. You didn't know who was going to move in overnight next to you. So there was a definite change.
Were there, as you got older, did you notice if there were less men or more men?
There were less men. They were still there. There was less men. And it's not something that I paid a lot of attention to, but there was less men working in the same areas that I used to work. Whereas prior to that 64 year, yeah, you could see the numbers were much bigger, much bigger.
Did you guys start having more undocumented people or not really? Or the
No,
same level of undocumented people?
it was about the same level of undocumented workers that would come in. And to me, what I saw was there was, first of all, the man would come over. And it seemed like they would be there for a few months. And they would integrate themselves into the workforce. And they kept to themselves because I think they knew they were illegal. But over a period of time, then you would see them, now they have a woman in their household. And then you'd see, you know, kids. And then those are the ones that overnight you'd say, wow, they're gone. Where'd they go? Well, whether they chose to pick up and leave or they were picked up somewhere else and deported, you never knew. But yeah, the numbers decreased over time. And I think the people that were more stable in the camps, like my family and a few other families, that was our house. That was where we grew up. That was where, you know, you went to school, the bus dropped you off. And I don't know if the illegals went outside of that workforce towards the Gila Bend, the Buckeye, you know, the other parts of Casa Grande, Southern California, those places, but definitely the numbers got smaller.
And I guess from the age of 4 to 10, you were living in this community when there was a lot of braceros. Was there ever anything extraordinary that happened? Illnesses or accidents that you noticed in your camp? Any amazingly interesting things that happened to specific families or?
No, I can't say that I remember anything like that at all.
Accidents, fires, nothing?
I don't even remember a fire in the whole time I was there. It's funny because I grew up to be a firefighter. And I don't remember any fires. I know we had a lot of them outside, warming fires, those types of things. But I don't remember any real big tragedies like that.
Except for Cuco.
Yes, and that was front page headlines for a lot of people. That struck a chord, an emotional chord with a lot of people. But no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the usual broken bones from kids playing, falling out of trees, and, you know, trying to build a treehouse 20 feet up. And we were mischievous. We were so mischievous, little Hispanic kids. And there was a family. We used to call them Okies. We didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. I guess Okies was an accepted term back then. Well, I don't think it was derogatory. We weren't defaming their character or anything. They were just from Oklahoma. I said, who are they? They're all white. They have blue eyes. They're from Oklahoma. Oh, those are Okies. Oh, okay. Up until then, I didn't know what they looked like. I didn't know an Okie. You know, until I started in school, I didn't know what blonde-haired, blue-eyed people looked like. Like I said, growing up in that camp, we were very isolated. That was our bubble. That was our playing field. We didn't venture outside of that at all. And if we did, we'd always go to another camp, which was identical to ours, just had a different number. So those people came over, a couple of them, Clyde and Larry. I'll never forget them, Clyde. Never heard the name Clyde. There was Humberto, Jose, Roberto, but Clyde. That was just odd. Why is your name Clyde? They were from Oklahoma. And come to find out later that they were no different than us. They were just Americans who just traveled working. I didn't know that happened. I thought that was just reserved for the people that spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. Kind of odd, but that's just the way it was.
Did your family eventually move out of the camp?
Yeah, we did. Believe it or not, we stayed in the camp up until I was about 17. And you think, well, at 17, my sister was already married. My sister married at age 16, by the way.
Wow.
She married a young man, same age, from the Waddell area, which was similar to a camp. It just didn't have the name camp. They met in school. They married. My mom and dad were as upset as I've ever seen them ever, because their little girl was getting married. And it's like, okay, so she's getting married. What it did is it took the older sibling out of the family group, and she went to live with this other family. She married Salvador. But we moved out later. There was government housing that was now being made available. People were referring to them as the projects, you know, things like that. My mom and dad made an application. I think there was certain requirements that you had to meet, and all we knew is that it was going to be a real house, not row housing that was attached to somebody else's. It was actually going to be a house with a garage, two bathrooms, three bedrooms, kitchen. It'll have a yard. So in about 1973, no, it had to be earlier than that, 1970-71 is when they actually got the application. They were able to buy the house through government assistance. You had to meet certain requirements. What those were at that time, I don't know. But that's when we moved out. It was about 1970. And a lot of the families, ironically, from the camps, guess what they did? It's like all of the families went to this place in what was called Lower Avondale. And they had a certain area identified that had these cookie-cutter homes, but they were houses. That's when we moved out. We all moved out of there. I went to high school. My brothers, sisters all went to high school and graduated. And from there, we all kind of went off and made a life of our own. And I think, looking back, I think we had a lot of fun in the camp. Met a lot of people, saw a lot of hardship. We worked really, really hard. We always did. Some of the funnest times we had was in the onion fields. I mean, and if you've ever picked yellow onions, I mean, they give you and assign you a certain row. They give you your clippers and, you know, your 3 or 4 or 5 gallon buckets, and you fill them up. And it was funny because we would assign each other jobs. I mean, I was pretty good. They used to call us toppers. I don't know what a topper was, but I was a topper. So me, my two brothers, and my older sister, we were the toppers. We would cut and put them in the bucket. And we would assign two of the younger kids to fill them and put them in the buckets, in the sacks. And every sack was a quarter. So you knew if you got four sacks, that was a dollar, right? But we worked, and we worked, and we worked, and we worked. We worked awfully hard growing up. But part of that work ethic, I think, was as a result of my mom and dad. They just instilled that in us. The one thing they were always very, very adamant about was an education. My dad spoke broken English. He was a bracero. He started out as a bracero. I think that program gave him an opportunity to raise a family, make a life, and instill some character and some work ethic in his kids. As I think about every member of my family, extremely successful, every one of us. We never would want to go back to that lifestyle, but it's that very lifestyle that allowed us to prosper and be as successful as we are.
What did you go on to do after high school?
Immediately after high school, I started as a firefighter. There was an opportunity there in the community in Avondale, and I took the test. I got hired as a firefighter. That's all I've ever done for the last 32 years. And people used to tease me because I was a little light-complected growing up. Some of the people in the camps, you know, how come you don't have an accent? I don't know. I just don't have an accent. None of us do. You know, we didn't have that traditional Cheech Marine accent. I mean, I can do one because I'm a funny guy, but we just never had it. But we used to get teased about that. But every member of my family. What's that?
You guys came young enough to the U.S.
I think so. I think we really did. And we certainly learned our lessons. We went to an all-white, very upscale Litchfield Elementary, which was back then probably the very one of the most affluent communities in the entire Maricopa County. And that taught us a lot of lessons. We learned a lot of hard lessons. You know, there were some times where the money, the layoffs from Goodyear Farms, I can remember three or four or five Christmases, you know, teasing with mom and dad, hey, when are we getting a tree? We're not having Christmas this year. Why not? Oh, they're just joking. They're going to go out and get the tree. No big deal. They're probably hiding the present somewhere. It's getting to like the 22nd, the 23rd of December. It's like, hey, man, this is really, they're really pushing it this year. Yeah, you guys aren't being funny. Of course, we're talking in Spanish. He says, that's not funny. He says, no vamos a tener Christmas este año, mijo. No hay dinero. And I'm going, you know, we worked awfully hard over the summer. Where'd all that cash go? But no gambling that I know of, or, you know. But, yeah, I remember some Christmases that, you know, you woke up on Christmas Day. It was just another day. I mean, there was nothing under the tree. And it's amazing because when you went to school, I remember going to school, hey, Elio, what'd you get for Christmas? You know, it's nothing, not much. What'd you get? Oh, I got a mini bike, and I got a color TV, and, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, I got a deck of cards and a pair of socks or whatever. But, no, there were some true hardships along the way. None of them have escaped me. But I think my mom and dad, along with a lot of other families there, I think they did the best that they could. But I think if you look back at the Bracero Project, I think you have to realize that that was an opportunity that you either took advantage of or you didn't. My dad was one of those that took advantage of it. While he never got to speak English, he never, you know, had an office job. He had a shovel on his back, and he worked as a farm laborer for all the years that I can remember. He didn't have a big retirement waiting for him in the end. He had what he had, and he passed away a few years ago. But a lot of it, I think, has to do with that Bracero Project that gave him that opportunity. And if I think back, he made the right choices, tough as they were. He took a big risk bringing his family here. But, you know, it was for all the right reasons.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share about your father or about the way you perceived the Bracero program or your father's experience with the Bracero program before I finished the interview?
Before my dad died, he died about 4 years ago, he had told me about five and a half years ago, he said, "Mira, mijo, you know, el gobierno nos quiere dar dinero para atrás cuando eran los braceros. Y este, no sé cómo a poner todos los papeles, juntar todo lo que tenemos, todos los documentos, me quieres ayudar." I helped him put these documents in order. And to be honest with you, he took care of that. And the way that my dad explained it to me is that the Bracero movement was owed money for the time of, and he mentioned the years, and now it's 1942 to 1964. If you were part of the Bracero movement at this point, there was money taken and given back to the Mexican government, a certain percentage of their money. It was never given back. Plus, there was either the same or a partial tax to the United States government. For what? I have no idea, but there was some act, either through Congress or something, about a way to reimburse Braceros if you were in this time frame. And I thought, wow, you know, that's kind of interesting that if you've had money coming to you, why are we waiting till almost 40 years after the fact, 35, 40 years? And the best that he could explain it to me, he says, "I don't know, but," he says, "I'm not going to be around much longer, but if it would help your mother, that would be a good thing." Filled out all the documentation that was needed. He took it to the people that he needed to take it to. He was taking care of that. I don't know whatever happened to it, but that's the one thing that I think you can look at the Bracero movement in various different ways. For my family, I think it gave us an opportunity that we might not otherwise have had through my dad. We may have stayed in Mexico. I might have been living in Mexico along with my brothers and sisters, and what kind of life we would have made there, who knows. But I think as life goes, I think there's certain opportunities that if you take advantage of them and you make the best of them, there's always going to be hardships along the way, and we definitely saw those. We tasted them. We absolutely lived them. We knew what those hardships were all about. Our clothes were never new, but they were never dirty. My mom kept a very tidy, very clean house. It wasn't a new couch. You know, the bedding wasn't brand new. It might have had a hole in it or whatever, but they were always clean. We didn't have the newest car, but I think along with that, and I think part of that has to do with the culture, there's a lot of pride instilled in the Mexican culture and in the Hispanic culture. Pride takes you a long way. Then after that, it's got to be work ethic, and my dad had both. We're thankful for that. A lot of experiences like racism along the way. I feel for that family now that may be here illegally, that has two or three little kids with them, that they go to a department store and they're speaking Spanish, where some of us may look at them and say, "Oh, you're here illegally. You don't belong here. You don't even speak the language." I have a different perspective on that. That was me. I was here legally. So was my family. But they're trying to make a life just like we were, you know, 35, 40 years ago. But it's all about opportunity. And the racism that I experienced, the discrimination that I experienced, is one that I can still remember how it stung. "You can't be in here." "Why not? You know, I speak English. I may not look like you. I don't dress like you, but I don't understand." As early as first grade, when I spoke Spanish and got slapped, racism was pretty rampant, discrimination, particularly towards the Braceros and the immigrants and the families that were the people who were putting food on your table. That was hard to swallow. And it either made you stronger, or you could crawl in your hole and just, be insecure the rest of your life. For us, it made us stronger. And we opted to realize that that's part of the differences that people have towards one another. And I talk about discrimination now to my kids. Some of the stories that I relate to them, they can't believe that that actually happened. And I can tell them, yeah, my family got thrown out of a supermarket when we were, you know, we still had our hats on, we smelled like onions, being asked to leave because you don't belong here. We don't want your type in here. That was hard to take, but growing up, made the best of what was given to us, a lot of opportunities, and to this day, we owe it all to my dad, part of that Bracero movement. So good things, bad things about the Bracero movement, biggest opportunity that my family took advantage of, particularly my dad. And along the way, you're in a different country. You know, make no mistake about it. Mexico, America, two different places. But we are who we are because of that.
Thank you very much.